you may have seen, is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Actors, right? The road to fame and celebrity. All right, I get it. You've had an incredible life.
Aren't you sick of hearing about them?
Me too.
The only problem is, I'm one of them. Except I'm not famous. Oh, you've probably seen me. A bunch of times. I'm the guy with the information about the hero's dad. I'm the doctor that can't figure out what's wrong with one of the main characters. I'm the guy they just punched in the face during the interrogation. My name's Brian LaFontaine, and I'm a professional actor. Oh, and it's not just me. There's a ton of us.
We're the ones you don't hear about.
Yeah, we're the names that scroll by at lightning speed during the end credits. But there's way more of us than there are of them. We're important too, dammit. Because without us, they can't tell the rest of the story. So this is for all the movie and TV prostitutes, homeless people, drug dealers, cab drivers, cops numbers 2, 3, and sometimes 4, the pilots, the waitresses, and girl at party.
This is You May Have Seen.
I can't believe it. I've got my good friend Julianne Emery. What a gift. It's a Christmas miracle. No joke, I had the pleasure of working alongside her at Christmas on the Coast, and now she was beyond kind enough to sit down with me in her limited time off to be on the podcast. I don't know what to say. I'm incredibly grateful. We talk Preacher, Catch 22, Being a Nomad, Star Wars. Yes, Star Wars. She's a Star Wars nerd. And we even sprinkle in a little Barry Manilow. Don't ask me how, but it seemed appropriate. So sit tight. Here comes Julianne.
Well, that'll teach me to try and put in a better set of headphones.
Where are you? Your home is in Charlotte?
Yeah.
Charlotte.
Yeah. I kept
getting it mixed up because Burgess is in...
Winston-Salem.
Winston-Salem. Right.
Burgess. Oh, my God. Burgess. We just worked on...
I was going to say, do you guys work together all the time? I mean, you're so close to each other.
Location-wise. Yeah, he's about 45 minutes away, an hour away, something like that. No, but we both were a part of this little series of shorts recently. You know, they asked me to do a couple in the series, and one of them was about this husband and wife who apparently, you know, they've been married so long and the things have gotten stale and flat. So he's going away on business and she's, you know, looking on Tinder and stuff like that. And so she comes across her old boyfriend and is trying to contemplate whether or not she's going to have an affair. And of course, I'm the husband.
Right.
And I had no idea. Like, I, you know, I meet up with them later that day to shoot my stuff with Jill and find out Burgess. And I texted him. I was like, would you please stop stealing every woman that I ever work with? Yeah. And for some reason, like, is it weird that I've had Barry Manilow in my head for a big part of the day today?
I mean, I feel like Barry Manilow always comes back around in life from time to time.
I don't know why he ever goes away.
Yeah, but I feel like it's like one of those things that his like earworms from Barry Manilow, maybe it's the holidays. I don't know. My mom was obsessed with Barry Manilow albums.
Yeah.
So like maybe it's like, I don't know, maybe it's like parents and the holidays or something. I don't know.
It's not even that it's holiday stuff. Like it's the classic Barry Manilow. Like Looks Like We Made It.
We know his lyricist. We know the guy who wrote all of those early hits with him. Like
like
Barry wrote the music and and he wrote the lyrics and he lives here in LA. Kevin has worked with him quite a bit, but like, it's really, and so every now and then Kevin does a cabaret for that guy and sings some of those songs.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's going to be cool.
He does like an evening of talking about sort of their past, of their journey of, they were like working in a mailroom, I think at CBS in New York together and then started writing music together. And it's
fantastic.
An interesting.
He was actually one of the first concerts that I ever saw.
It's a worthy concert. He's a musician.
It was great.
He's an artist. He's the real deal.
It was an incredible show. And my father was supposed to go with my mom. They bought tickets, I don't know, for their anniversary or something like that. And then he had to go in for a double hernia operation.
Shit.
So this was years ago. This is when I was like 15 years old. So clearly he could not go. So my mom was like, do you want to come with me to see Barry Manilow? And I was like, all right. It was unbelievable.
It was truly
amazing. And now it's great that we've started this interview talking about Barry Manilow for a good 5 minutes.
Sure, why not? Right.
So Julianne Emery, where may we have seen you?
That's always a really embarrassing question for me. seen me in Christmas on the Coast with your very host of this very podcast.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can.
But mostly on the small screen, I guess. Mm-hmm. Most recently, I just the final season of Preacher just aired from ANC, and Catch 22 with George Clooney and Chris Abbott is up on Hulu right now. I think that's the latest and greatest. I'm turning a little red right now.
I know, right?
I don't talk about my own resume very well.
I know, it's going to be great. Don't worry, I'm going to list all of your highlights, and it's going to be fantastic because I went back, of course, and I looked at your entire body of work, at least that I could find on the internet, and some of the shows that you've been on, I was like, oh, you were on this show? So yes, I am talking to Julianne Emery, who you might know very well as Lara Featherstone.
Yes. Although it was revealed, spoiler alert, if you haven't watched the final episode, what Featherstone's real name is, and it's not Lara.
Okay. I have not. I've seen some of the episodes. What a fun show. Yes, Lara Featherstone on Preacher. You did Catch 22 with, like you said, with George Clooney. You have been seen in The Rookie, Better Call Saul, the TV series Fargo, NCIS, Major Crimes, Hitch, Taken, ER, Dexter, Royal Pains, Army Wives, Commander in Chief, Alias. You were on Alias.
I was.
And you were on Providence, the TV show Providence, which yes. I loved that show.
Really early on, yeah.
I'm from Rhode Island, so I mean, when that was on, I watched it.
I loved
it.
That show.
As
I was a big fan
as it
of
was.
That show.
Yes.
I was a big fan of it. Yeah.
The Drew Carey Show, which was your first one, according to IMDb.
Yes.
And yes. A wonderful little Christmas movie with me called Christmas on the Coast. And then you're going to be in the new season of Bosch on Amazon Prime. Is that right?
I am. I'm shooting season 6 of Bosch right now.
That is incredible. That's
amazing. It's great.
Does it feel weird to hear all that stuff listed like that?
Yeah, it does not feel like my life. Well, you're an actor, you know. It doesn't. You feel right. like you're just always like, I don't know, hustling for your next job and hitting it hard and trying to make the next thing happen. Or,
exactly.
It doesn't feel like. I mean, I'm very proud that I'm a working actor. I feel like I'm a journeyman actor. Like
I've heard you say that.
I'm not George Clooney. I'm and I tend to visually morph a little bit, role to role, which I really like. And.
Right.
So I'm proud to have popped around to so many different series and stuff, but yeah, it's that sounds impressive when you say it out
right?
loud. It doesn't feel like that in my life. But
no, but I'm sure even as I list it, I wonder if you're actually thinking back like, oh my God, I was this age. Oh my God, I was this age, or that was that long ago, whatever. And to think of where you are now, like, holy crap, how did I get here?
I don't know. You know, it's interesting. Somebody asked me recently in an interview, if I was doing what I always dreamed of doing, like if I wanted to be doing this when I was a little kid, and I was like, no, I grew up on a dairy farm in Tennessee. Like this was not on my radar. Like there was a theater in my hometown and they provided a drama teacher for my high school. It was the Cumberland County Playhouse. I did my early stuff there. And then from there, they helped me audition for theater schools and I got into a theater school. But even when I was in theater school, I wasn't thinking I could be on TV. I was thinking maybe I could make a living doing regional theater. This is so great. This is so cool. Like, or maybe one day, maybe I'll be in a Broadway show. But like, I don't know, the television film world was so very much not even didn't even seem like a possibility. It just wasn't on my radar at all.
No, right? It was the same for me growing up in Rhode Island. I mean, I'm the smallest state in the country. You're sitting there and you watch it and you think, wow, that would be so cool. But that's not me. That's in another world. That's somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, movies, you know, movies and television. If you follow me on social media at all, you know, I'm a sci-fi nerd. And I'm a very much a fantasy fan. And I grew up reading a lot of fantasy and science fiction. And I watched a lot of that on screens when I was growing up. I think television and film were a true escape for me. And I still feel like a fan of that stuff a lot now, even sometimes when I'm in it. But I think it was my escape. So it didn't seem like something that could happen in real life. Like it didn't seem, it just didn't seem, logical sounds weird because I was trying to be an actor anyway. And that's definitely not logical being where I'm from. But
right.
It just wasn't on my radar. I didn't. I can't believe I'm working. Like I can't. I'm legit paying my bills. I keep just being grateful for that, and hoping that my best roles aren't behind me. Like right now, I'm having a moment where Featherstone was such a chameleon. Like I played five or six roles in one, And season four Featherstone is action villain for sure. I did wire work. I jumped off a cliff. I was in all these fight scenes. I killed a bunch of my own men even just for annoying me. And then, you know, Betsy Kettleman is on my list. And yeah. Fargo and Ida was her own. I've had in the last 4 or 5 years some really challenging and special roles.
Sure.
That now I'm going, holy crap, how do I follow that up? What am I supposed to be looking for right now? Like,
right. But the biggest surprise for me, just knowing you the way that I got to know you, you have had the opportunity to do some really great yet darker roles, and you're so yep. cute and adorable. And I'm like, how is that possible? I mean, I get how that's possible.
Yeah, I've done some dark stuff.
Yeah.
I've played serial killers a couple of times. I did this episode of something called The Inside, where I played a woman who was killing pregnant women and cutting their baby out of their body and then pretending and then I thought the dead baby was my baby. Like, I mean, it was like, I've done some, and I started my career doing mostly drama. You know what I think it is? I like to stretch my skill set as wide as possible. Mm-hmm. I know some actors really like to find their slot and where they go and what they do, and they have a thing they do. And I really admire that. But what keeps my attention is continually sort of expanding my skill set. And that's, comedy came to me that way. And I'm kind of obsessed with tone.
Sure.
When I read a script or I read a pilot, like an episode of television that I haven't seen, yep. when you're like figuring out what tone makes the material work. Fargo is a really good example of that.
Right.
Like Fargo, season one of Fargo is dark and funny. I always say Ida is the light in the darkness in Fargo. Fargo, if you played the comedy even a bit, if you like put your toe on it even a little bit, mm-hmm. it blew it.
Sure.
Like you had to like go so far back. You had to just like all day long, I'm like, do less. Like that's a really specific tone though. And that's where those characters would fly. So I love finding what the writing is and what the magical combination of tone and where it sits is to make it sort of sing.
I'm more sort of blown away by the fact that you've had the opportunity, in my opinion, again, to sort of, I don't know, do you feel like you've kind of like broken the barriers or broken the mold a little bit of what people would automatically assume that you would fit into type-wise, and you're kind of like, no, F that. I'm going this
way. Yeah. So I had it really early on. You know, there was a moment when I was dropped by William Morris. So I was at William Morris.
Yes.
And they dropped me. One of the agents, I guess we mutually dropped each other. One of the agents took me out to lunch, and he was mm-hmm. like, I know the problem with you. I don't recognize you project to project. I was recurring on two shows at once, and the roles were very far apart from each other. Mm-hmm. Like, and I wasn't even visually really recognizable between the two of them. And they sure. were on television at the same time.
Right.
He's like, this is a problem. You need to decide what you do. And I was like, that is a problem. Cause I'm always going to be interested in something that's the opposite of what I just did. And that right. is really sort of creatively what drives me. And mm-hmm. I like to be challenged, and I'd like to, if it's too comfortable, I don't trust it very much. Like yeah. I like to push those boundaries. I said, dude, that is a problem. I don't think we can't work together. If you can't rep that, then I have to go find someone who can.
Yeah.
So it's a longer journey in mm-hmm. the business. Like it's a longer, I had a manager once say, you're going to have to educate people about who you are because they can't put you in a box. And that takes longer. But I am really proud that I haven't been pigeonholed, that I haven't been put in a box. And then once Vince Gilligan cast me to play a character like Betsy Kettleman, now it feels like I'm allowed to do anything in the room. Like now they get me in the audition room. Hmm. Like, and I think it's just his permission. I really think that I'm doing the work I've always done in that room. It's
sure.
just when I'm different than what they expect me to be. Now that seems okay for them instead of it being confusing for them.
So was Better Call Saul sort of like a big shifting point for you then career-wise?
Yeah, it was. It's interesting. I know everybody talks about getting breaks. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's one break. I've had moments that shifted things for me.
Yeah.
Like my first series, I was an FBI agent and that shifted things. And then I was playing a girl with a gun a lot yeah. and doing that kind of stuff. Better Call Saul, I think, was the shift I'd been looking for my entire career. Like, I think that it was the business finally saw what I was trying to do. Like the business finally sort of got on board with the way I was trying to move through my own work. I don't think that's a very good explanation of it, except maybe it was just that the way I was doing my work was suddenly okay with people.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Or made sense to them.
Because you didn't start out going so deep and dark and diverse and kooky. Didn't you start doing musical theater like most kids?
Yeah, I started musical theater. Yeah, I started in musical theater, dancing in the chorus, understudying the lead, you know. And my first national tour was, funny thing happened on the way to the Forum. I mean, all of that, like Christmas on the Coast, the timing of that kind of comedy or that kind of lightness feels like a throwback to most of the work I did on stage. I mean, I also did heavy stuff on, like I did Fiddler. Huddle and Fiddler was one of my first roles I got paid for. And did some darker musicals as well. I did a musical version of Elmer Gantry, and I played the Shirley Jones role. I know.
I don't even know what that is.
It's a movie. Shirley Jones got nominated for it for an Oscar, actually, back in the day. Yeah. So, maybe that's why mixing in comedy and drama and stuff doesn't bother me. I loved Christmas on the Coast. This is going to sound totally weird because it's a light romantic holiday Christmas movie. But one of my favorite things about it was that I got to stretch comedically, and then I got to have these really grounded emotional moments, and they all worked in the same movie. And that is partly due to Post. I thought the music on the show was really good and helped that a lot. But I was really happy with sort of how wide the parameters on that character were able to be.
And was it a nice sort of break from the dark craziness that you had been doing?
Yeah, I'd been doing my first season of Preacher. I had like two episodes off, and I came into Christmas on the Coast in the middle of it. And Preacher is bloody and gory, and it's funny sometimes. I mean, it's got its own sense of humor, but it's a dark sense of humor.
Yes.
I like the opposite of what I just did. You know, Marion actually in Catch 22 is, even with all of the different personas I play on Preacher, Marion was completely different than anything I'd ever played before. I've never been so stunned to be cast in anything in my life. Like,
really?
It was, yeah, because it's the casting director who cast me in season one of Fargo, Rachel Tenner, and they didn't see me for a long time. They saw a lot of women for that role, apparently, but because she was like, I know Julianne, I love Julianne, she's not what they're looking for. They were really looking for a Marilyn Monroe type that was kind of halfway in between the age of George Clooney and Chris Abbott. And she's like, she's just not what they're looking for. And then finally they saw me, but I was in New Orleans shooting Preacher season three, and I couldn't come to town. So I taped, and I think I just guessed the tone right. I'm a big fan of the films that Grant Heslov and George Clooney, that their company does. And I was like, oh, I know what this is. Men Who Stare at Goats. This is Monuments Men. These are some of the movies that they've done in the past. I was like, that's what this tone is. I think I just guessed the tone right. And then they wanted me to come in to LA and meet George and Grant, and I couldn't because I was shooting every day. And so they sent notes, and I taped again, and I was like, nobody books this job.
Wow.
Like this. And then they asked for pictures of me blonde. And we had some Preacher photos of me from my first persona with long blonde hair, very different blonde. I got the job offer. I don't know. I mean, I was like, nobody gets this job without walking in that room and meeting those guys.
Right.
But
wow.
Yeah, but I was not visually what they had in their head. Mm-hmm. And they changed the way I visually looked. They built this beautiful wig for me in Rome. They handmade it hair by hair. I got off the plane and went straight to the wig maker. Like it's stunning and gorgeous. And every now and then, you know, you put on a costume or you put on a wig or you put on a full face of makeup and you're like, oh, there's the character. Like I've been doing all my character work, but then suddenly they put that wig on me I'd been on a 12-hour flight. The car was waiting outside. I went straight from the airport to the wig maker, and they put the wig on me, and I was like, oh, yeah, there she is. And I like suddenly felt physically where she sat, and I don't know. She suddenly just sensed me. Yeah. Yeah.
So, again, I'm just going to remind you again. Does any of this just kind of ring as insane, dairy farmer girl?
Yeah, I don't think of that part of it very much. I get, obviously, I go down a big rabbit hole with my characters. Yes. Like, obviously, I go deep into my characters.
But I mean, even just going, like,
say this.
The flight was 12 hours, the car was waiting for me, they took me directly to the wig place and whatever. Yeah. Do you ever stop and go?
I will, dairy farm. I had a moment at the Catch-22 premiere that I was like, oh my God, what is my life? This is crazy. I don't look anything like my character in Catch-22, and I never walked in the room and met those guys.
Right.
So they saw me. George saw me with my wig cap on before the wig, but they only really saw me there as Marion, like through hair and makeup, everything's done. So I took a 15-hour flight from Australia back to LA for the Catch-22 premiere.
Yes.
We were on the ground for like 48 hours, and then I was on another 15-hour flight. And I said to my husband, I was like, why am I doing this? This is crazy. Nobody's going to know who I am. Like, the people I worked with in it are not going to know who I am. I'm going to have to just spend the evening going up to people and introducing themselves, saying, hi, I'm Julianne. Yeah. I play Marion, which feels wrong, you know? And my husband was, Kevin was like, well, you just got to get right with it. This is what we're doing right now. And I was on the red carpet, and I'd gotten through the photos, and I'm waiting for interviews. And suddenly I hear from behind me, Julianne. And I turn around, and it's George Clooney blowing off a bunch of interviewers to come talk to me.
That's so great.
I was like, okay, this is happening. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't seen any of the footage, and I spend a fair amount of the movie without clothes.
Yes.
And of the show. And so he's like, have you seen anything? And it was at the Chinese theater on IMAX. And so I was having, you know, a lot of anxiety about that situation. Matt Damon sat right behind us at the premiere, and I was like, and there are my tatas, and there's on IMAX, and there's that's Matt Damon and Don Cheadle right there behind me. Okay, like, it was, but I mean,
I'm so glad that you brought this up and have given, you've opened the can, because I'm sorry, I love you, but I so badly want to ask you, what the hell was it like for you? Did you stop and go, I'm about to be naked in front of George Clooney?
Yeah, you can't really think of it that way.
Of course
or
you
else
can't.
You'll just, like, go nuts. Right, like, right. Like, look, I will say this. In the era of Me Too, and I've done stuff where I've had to take off my clothes and hop in the sack with someone.
Sure.
It's been in my career, it's been handled well, it's been handled incredibly poorly.
Absolutely.
I once looked at a guy on cut and I said, if you do that again, I'm gonna rip your balls off. Like, I've had that moment where I'm like, that's not what we blocked in the scene.
Right.
Don't touch me. You know, like, I've had those moments.
Yes.
And Catch-22 for me was the best that situation has ever been handled. It's also the most naked I've ever gotten.
Right.
Like, I went further than I probably would have because they handled it so well. Mm-hmm. I was very empowered. Grant was the director for episode one, and that's where we're actually having sex. Like, that's the
gotcha.
There's a montage of Chris Abbott and I having sex. And so he really was wildly uncomfortable, you know, because sometimes directors are just cowards about it. They're just cowards about it.
Sure.
Like, they don't want to deal with it. And that's where it goes wrong, you know? So Grant comes to Chris Abbott and I, and he goes, do you guys just want to go? I mean, we need different positions, but do you just want to go and we'll film stuff? And both of us were like, no.
There's no going.
And Grant was like, okay. And he pulled up a chair and he's like, well, let's talk about what we're going to do. And he was, I mean, red-faced and wildly uncomfortable, but he stuck with us. You know, like, he really stuck with us through a difficult conversation, and it made all of those days go so much better. Like, because then Chris and I knew what we were doing. We were comfortable with each other.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, look, I know you have a shot list. Tell me what's on your shot list. Mm-hmm. What are you looking for? And then let us help fill that in for you or fill that out for you. Like, so it's. And Chris Abbott is also a lovely human being, and that helps a lot. Who your partner is on that day is everything. And although we did look at each other at one point, and I looked at him. I was like, if you ever see me on the street in New York, you cannot pretend to not know who I am. Like, we've gone too far here to ever be anonymous to each other again. But it's challenging, you know, and the monitors are, it's George Clooney and Grant Heslov. And, I mean, on the flip side of that, both of those guys are actors, and George has done a lot of those scenes. So he was very empathetic. I mean, he sort of started the day going, God, when I was doing this with Jennifer Lopez, like he's like starting the day going, he's like, look, I've had nightmare situations with this and I've had good ones. I would like to make this a good one. So in a lot of ways, I mean, in some ways, you can't think of it as George Clooney sitting over there, but you have to, but in a lot of ways it helped that it was George Clooney sitting over there because he's like, look, I've done this and it's gone badly and I've done this and it's gone well. So let's do better than the best one I've done. They were insanely welcoming and the cast is all men. So there are very few women in the, I was never on set with another actress. My first day on set was the parade scene where I'm sitting with George in the stands and they're doing the military parades. And there were a couple of female extras, but not even, I mean, there were 150 Italian male extras in uniforms that day. And I walked on the set in that blonde wig and I had a bullet bra and tatsy little outfit. Yeah. And everybody was talking, like, you know, 300 people are talking, and then everything went silent. And I walked all the way across because the cast chairs were like across a football field from there.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, this is who Marion is. This is there what Marion feels like. Okay. Yep. But
that's a great experience.
Did a really good job. Yeah, it was a beautiful, it was such a lucky, beautiful job. And Grant and George, I would sweep the floor on one of them, their sets. They really handled all of it just insanely well. Like, I can't praise them enough because I feel like we're outing a lot of bad behavior in this way right now. I feel like we also have to champion when folks do it right.
Absolutely.
And they definitely did it right in every possible way.
Were you with Preacher from the beginning?
No,
you were a regular, but did you start?
No, I joined in season two, and I joined as a regular. So Preacher season one is a prequel to the comics. So a lot of us that play characters from the comics began in season two. Season two picks up with the first frame of the comics.
I was under the impression that you had been like a recurring guest star and they moved you up to series regular. You came on as a series regular.
I came on as a regular. I came on the first season. I was on a partial contract. So I was in like half the episodes the first season that I was in season two when I was on. But yeah.
And you, Pip Torrens.
Yeah.
I love that guy.
I know. He's so brilliant. And he's also just one of the most wonderful human beings on the planet. I love him so much. I miss him terribly right now. His wife is like a British hippie. I mean, it's just so fantastic.
Yeah.
More with Julianne in just a minute. You're listening to You May Have Seen, proud member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. There are so many great podcasts on the network, and they're adding new ones all the time, showcasing great stories by great people and shining a spotlight on the Queen City. You can find them all at queencitypodcastnetwork.com. Shoutouts! Christmas on the Coast! I was so proud and grateful to be a part of that movie. Be on the lookout for it during the holidays. It had a fairly small cast, but some truly amazing actors that you may have seen, like Julia Denton, who plays Marion in Christmas on the Coast. You may have seen her as Janet in The Fundamentals of Caring with Paul Rudd, and as former beauty queen in the Netflix movie Dumplin'. And Justin Torrance, who plays Lord Wesley in Christmas on the Coast. You may have seen Justin as Brad on the TV series MacGyver, and as Army Recruiter in the YouTube original series Cobra Kai. Sweep the leg, no mercy! All right, that was the Karate Kid, but still. Drop me a note at youmayhaveseen@gmail.com. Leave us a review. I'd love to hear from you. Okay, here's more with Julianne.
I like transformation.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
I like... Also, that gives me the ability to disappear into a role for you. Like, as a viewer,
absolutely,
you shouldn't be watching me. You should be watching the story. You should be watching the character. If I've done my job, you're watching the character.
Yeah. I love that you call yourself a journeyman actor. I've used that term so many times, and it was actually a little surprising to hear you say that because you're at a fairly high level in the business, but I mean that you still see yourself as, I don't know.
I don't think I'll ever see myself otherwise. And I'll tell you what I mean. I think anyone who sees their journey role to role, you know, I work with actors sometimes who are worried about how whatever they're doing in the moment affects their brand, who they are, you know what I mean? Their, sure. their image. Yeah. And that's, you know, and look, there are careers that's not escapable from. Like, mm-hmm. I think Meg Ryan was always Meg Ryan, right? Like, and people expected her to be that. And when she tried to not be that, people were, you know, not excited about that. But I think anyone who moves role to role like that, character to character, is a journeyman actor. I'm really proud to be a journeyman actor. Best actors I've worked with are journeyman actors. No question. Hands down. Yes. Yeah.
Taekwondo?
Mm-hmm.
What?
So
I did not know that.
Okay, so
I made it to green belt.
I made it to purple belt, and awesome. I was so I when I booked my first series, I was an FBI agent. Mm-hmm. It was a show called Line of Fire. I was the smallest person in the cast, and like they had to call the extras casting and say, "Could you please send a, you know, people who are shorter so that Julianne doesn't look like a child?" Because they would. So even when they sent women to be extras in the FBI office, they were like 5'10" or 6 feet tall. Right. They were tall women. Like they leaned into the stereotype of the kind of woman that might do this. And so I was like, I'd like to know how to handle myself. I think it'll affect how I play the role because I'm that nerdy of an actor. My character on the show didn't know Taekwondo. I just thought it might. And we were doing like in the pilot, I had to take a guy down. We were doing some physical stuff. And because I was small, I wanted to look like I knew how I could, yeah. I knew how to handle myself.
Sure.
So I started taking Taekwondo and I loved it so much. And then we were, I was shooting at one point. Once you get to purple belt, you have to start, sparring with your, well, yellow belt, we started sparring, but we really started mixed belt sparring when I was a purple belt. And I was shooting and they put, you know, a mask on me and everybody's supposed to hit to the torso.
Right.
But I was in a class with all guys and they were all taller than me and my face was at their torso. And you know, so I kept getting hit in the face. And at one point a guy got his glove stuck in my, mask cause he did a side punch and I got scratched. And then I went to work and my producers were like, you have to stop doing that.
Sure.
So I go drop back in when I can. I mean, cause the master there was like, you can spar with black belts, but it was just so, it was so sad to spar with black belts. They were always so far ahead of me. But I loved it so much. So I dropped back in when I'm between jobs still. But I loved it. I recommend it for anybody. It affects everything. Look, I've had a lot of gun training for my jobs. And fight stance and gun stance are the same. The idea is 70-30. I mean, the weight distribution is the same. On Preacher, I do a ton of fight work. And the first time I met John Koyama, we spent 5 minutes doing some stuff and he was like, okay, what have you done? Like you move too well to what do you, and I did used to dance in musical theater. I was like, well, I used to dance and I took Taekwondo. And he was like, great. So here's how this is the same and here's how it's different, what we're doing here. And then as we moved through the seasons, he would start to choreograph things for me that he knew would fit with like a Taekwondo training with like that kind of stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
So did you ever just randomly kick your husband's ass around the apartment whenever you got bored or anything like that?
So I used to come home, you know, because you do a lot of holds in Taekwondo.
Yes.
You know that, right? But I would come home and be like, hey, I want to practice. Come here. I'll show you something. Grab me. And then he's like on the ground.
And for
like
people,
one day he's like, honey, I'm really glad you know how to do this, but you have to stop doing this if you would.
And just for people who don't know, Julianne's husband is a very tall man. she is not. He's a big guy.
He's a big guy. And I'd be like, grab me, just grab me. And then suddenly he'd be on the ground. And he's like, ow, ow. But here's the thing about something like Taekwondo. You know, I live in a lot of different places. We're very nomadic, my husband and I, and one of them being New York. And I always say in New York, I'm like, look, you just have to look like too much trouble for someone to mess with you. So Taekwondo will do that for you. It'll make you more physically confident. It'll make you feel like you can handle yourself. It'll make you feel like Master Nagayama used to say, we would have days where he would say, okay, street day. We're having a street day. Someone comes up to you and they, you know, and they're trying to take you away. He's like, where do you kick them? You don't kick them in the torso. You kick them in the balls. Too bad for them. You know, Taekwondo. He's like, let's talk about the best kick for that. He's like, No, but he's like, too bad genius. For them. They picked the wrong person. He's like, yeah, but it was, he was, I think it affects how you feel about yourself, how you move through the world. Yeah.
I love that.
And I really recommend it for women, and not a ton of women take something like Taekwondo.
Okay.
Women have a lower sense of balance. They do. They have a lower sense. It's and women have usually have a really good kick automatically because your center of gravity is lower. So women are really good with their legs. And if you can kick someone there, that's further away from you than your arm, then you can punch them. I highly recommend it. Ladies, come on in, jump into the Taekwondo water.
See, I'm letting you talk right now because you're speaking from experience. I'm not, you know, I'm going to take your word for it that
women.
No, I know, for women to take it, yes.
Yeah.
So.
Also, all right. You know, kick somebody in the, you know, go for it.
Terrible. Go for it. I mean, yeah, tell me, Nomad, because I know you still spend time in Tennessee, or you are in New York, or I don't know where the hell you are.
Honestly, from last year, from... what, July to July, over the last year, I spent 8 out of the 12 months across one of the oceans. So, right. So last year I was in New Orleans for 5 months on Preacher. Then I was in LA for a couple weeks, and then I was in Italy for 2 months on Catch 22. And then I came back and traveled for some indie films. And then January to July of this year, I was in Australia for Preacher season 4. And now I'm in LA shooting season 6 of Bosch. I don't really live anywhere. I mean, I have a place in LA right now, and I think we'll be here through the end of the year. I have no idea after that. My husband and I don't have, you know, we try to, Kevin is a theater actor. He's a Broadway singer. He does a lot of pre-Broadway tryouts all over the country. Mm-hmm. He does a lot of plays. He just finished doing a play in Pennsylvania, and I had an episode off from Bosch. So as soon as I had an episode off, I just went out. We try to travel with each other now if we can.
Sure.
Like he was with me during Christmas on the coast for 2 weeks, and then he went to do a play. Right. So we realized we had a moment in our lives where we had an apartment in New York. We had only been in it together for 5 weeks all year, and that was not consecutively. And we were like, you know, we need to change the way our lives work. We need to change the way our finances work. We need to change the way our lives work so that we are in the same place together more often. And honestly, self-tapes are much more popular now, and that has helped us a lot. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I'm a little guerrilla filmmaker, so I have really good equipment and lighting and, you know. And we have stuff we travel with, and then we go and just be together as much as we can. So like he was in Salt Lake City last year for 6 weeks doing a play after I finished Catch 22. So I just went with him. So we try, I mean, home for us is wherever we can sleep in the same bed together.
Sure.
Yeah. It can be unsettled, you know.
It seems like you guys have made it work for quite a while.
Yeah. We've made this work for a long time. I don't know. I mean, I feel like at some point, like I just happened to end up on a series that was always going to move every season, like that was not meant to be in one place. I feel like at some point I'll end up on a series that sits down somewhere and will settle down somewhere more permanently. But yeah.
All right. So we've spent a lot of time talking about all your more recent successes over the years. Let's go back. Let's take a journey. Let's take a stroll.
I'm scared.
Let's go back to the earlier days. Tell me, was the Drew Carey Show your first TV booking?
ER was my first TV booking.
ER was.
Yeah, so Drew Carey came pretty quickly after it. So Kevin was on tour with Les Mis, and they sat down in LA for like 4 months, and we were living in New York, and he was like, you should come out here. Because I was just starting, I'd been taking some on-camera classes in New York, and I was like, I think this is where my work was meant to be. Like Kevin and I went to theater school together, we were in conservatory together, and my teachers, his instincts automatically play for stage. Like he understands how it works. He understands instinctually how to play in a 3,000 seat house. Even everything just reads on him. He's just really gifted that way. Mm-hmm. I was not. My teachers were always writing me to play to the back of the house and physicalize bigger. And I've always been more interested in I think inner monologue and characters' thoughts in what's going on internally. And so I think I was always, it wasn't on my radar, but I think where my work sits was probably always headed towards something on camera. I think that was always going to be more. Yeah. So we came to LA. I'd been in LA for a year. I went in for ER 7 times before I booked it. I had a manager, couldn't get an agent, had a manager, and she just championed me and knocked down doors and, you know, screamed and yelled till people saw me. And, I 7 times. I mean, once you've been in for something a certain number of times, you're like, they're never going to cast me. What am I doing here?
I'm sorry. I'm going to call, cause you were on Army Wives.
Yes, I was on Army Wives.
I auditioned for that show 37 times and never got booked on it. 37 times.
I mean, sometimes, look, I always tell young actors, I'm like, look, if you're going back in, it means the casting director likes you. They're looking for something for you. But it's really hard to believe that in the moment. But it is true that means someone there likes you. Some producer has said, keep her on the list. It's not going to be her, but keep her on the list. Some casting director is like, it's not going to be this, but I'm getting you on this thing. You're so good. You know, someone is championing you in that situation. So I've been in 7 times. I booked it. And I booked the best role I'd gone in for, frankly. Like I played this paramedic who got trapped in an elevator with Eric Palladino's character. He was the bad boy on the show for a little while. It was Anderson's last season on the show. Anthony Edwards. I was just watching Blackish on Hulu this morning. I'm sorry. It was Anthony Edwards' last season on the show. And it was Eric Palladino's exit from the show. So we saved a guy in an elevator together, and then Laura Innes caught us in my ambulance, you know, and fired him. And then the show, it went really well, but I didn't know what I was doing. My first day on set, we're really famous for oneers. If you don't know what that is, that's like shooting a scene with a steady cam all in one shot. There's going to be no break in the editing. Sure. So they were very famous. The way they shot all of their ER scenes was, you know, the camera would pull you into another room and somebody was doing this, and then it would follow somebody on a gurney out into another room, and then it would catch this doctor, or, you know, this patient.
Like the West Wing, like they were famous for.
That's right. That's right. Except ER did it first and longer. So my first day on set, we did a 7-page oneer. We spent the entire morning. It was my first day on set. It was my first television show. I'd done some indie stuff, but this was my first real, I mean, there were, you know, what, a 75, 80, 100, 125 person crew. Like, I was in, so I was at the end of those 7 pages and I rode a gurney in, humping a guy's chest, saying multiple GSW, so that, blah, 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 like saying
yes,
all of these.
Yes. Right? All the doctor medical jargon. Oh my God, I'm already sweating for you. I'm already sweating for you.
And when we started, we did the whole morning was just rehearsal. And then we went to lunch and then we came back and Meek Nall looked at me. They kept not making it to my part of the scene.
Oh, wow.
Because somebody would mess up.
Yep.
And the director was one of their producing directors, so he would openly yell at them for messing up. And Meek Nall looked at me and she's like, oh, don't fuck it up. I mean, I was like
no pressure.
Because I must have sweat through my paramedic uniform 15 times. Like I just kept saying it over and over again. And the doc will come bust you. Like in rehearsal, the doc would come and say, that's great. You have to squeeze the bag every 3 seconds. That's great. When you pump the chest, it's every second and a half. You have to match what a heart is. Because they had onset doctors that would block the trauma scene. And I'm like, oh, you're serious. I'm like, okay. I was like. So I did make it through the day. Mm-hmm. It felt like an out-of-body experience. I never messed it up. But it was the most nerve-wracking, terrifying thing I've ever done on camera, including taking all of my clothes off in front of George Clooney. And for work. I did that for work. And
in ER, that makes sense. It should feel that way, shouldn't it?
Yes. And then, I you know, because I managed to not mess it up, I was like, I was the hero because we made it to the end. Like it was, and then the rest of the episode went really beautifully. I like business. I like props. I like primary, secondary focus. I will generally, you've been on set with me. I will ask for something to do in the scene if not given something to do because it helps me. So, it's I took to the rest of what we were doing very well. And I'd come from stage, so resetting made sense to me. Like,
sure.
It was, yeah. And I did do some hard stuff in that episode, but then they invited me back to recur, just as one of their recurring paramedics.
Still.
And I did enough of it to quit my waiting tables job. But Drew Carey came sort of in the midst of that. But okay. Yeah, in between episodes of ER, Drew Carey came.
But I mean, the fact that you got truly baptism by fire on one of the most popular shows on television at the time.
It was insane. Like, I felt like I was dehydrated. I sweat so much. I mean, I came home and my husband was like, well, it probably won't get harder than that, really. He's like, it probably won't get more nerve wracking than that. You might play a harder role. You might be in a more high pressure. So he's like, it probably won't feel that high pressure again because you've done that. Like, and he was right. Like, that moment, I was like, I mean, I got through the 7-page oneer on ER. I think I'll be fine. Like, it's going to be okay. Yeah.
And doing the medical stuff like that, I mean,
I've
played doctors a lot. Yeah. But you do the audition and you get the dialogue right and all this stuff and you book the job and then you get in there and they're like, okay, here's all your stuff. And you're going, I'm not really a doctor, you know?
Well, and ER was the show that decided they were going to really try to do it the way they would do it in an ER. So like they would teach me how to run a line, how to put an IV in someone.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they just swap out the fake needle for it. But they're like, this is actually how it happens. And you're not looking for the vein. You see where that vein is? You need to put it right there. They're like, I mean, it was,
wow.
It was intense. So whenever I was doing an episode of ER, I would do my lines. I would practice my lines. Instead of just running my lines with Kev or whatever, I would do the dishes and do my lines. I would fold the laundry, give myself activities, as many activities as I could think of while I was doing them. So it would kind of help on the day. But yeah, it's a shock when you get there. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I had all those experiences as well. I mean, geez, I got to do it with, do you know Charles Esten, Chip Esten?
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, I don't, not personally, but I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Nashville, I worked with him on Nashville.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's got a huge improv background. And I, same thing. I had that same situation where it's like, once you get in there and you're moving everything and you have to remember all the medical terms. And I was just going, and so in between takes, he was like, come here. And we would do all these, he would do all these improv exercises with me and literally throw stuff at me while we would run the scene. And man, it made all the difference in the world. And I was so grateful.
Yeah, because you have to... You have to, primary, secondary focus. You have to be able to do some of it. Like it's nothing. Like it's your secondary focus. Like you do it a million times a day. But see, if I were casting someone to do something like that, I would cast you because you're always really prepared. You always have, you're very present in the scenes. You're always on top of it, but you're very present. Like I've watched you juggle props and figure it out and figure out what that is. And not all actors are able to do that. So if I were, I think you're the perfect person to be cast in something like that. I would totally cast you in something like that.
You are very sweet.
Some people, I don't think it's this kind of actor or that kind of actor. I think some people are just, you're a very actionary person. You're very upfront. I mean, you know, there's some things
in our personalities that
carry into our work. And that's, you're really good with business and with everything that's happening around you. And you're always on top of things. Like you can't cast someone in a role like that who shows up to set and hasn't looked at the script.
I do know what you mean.
It happens. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I would cast you in that in a hot second. You're perfect for it.
All right. Jack of all trades. So you're also creating your own stuff too, right?
Yes.
You said you've got some stuff going
scary
on.
Well, yeah, I have a web series that came out in 2009, 2010 when it was still the Wild West, and we won some awards and did very well, but it was just all my brilliant actor friends in my living room in New York. Like I wrote something that we could shoot in my living room because it's impossibly expensive to shoot anything in New York. So we shot on $350 camcorders because that's what we could afford.
Yep.
And we upgraded our sound between season one and season two. My mama came up for every shoot day and cooked for us all day long. We shot for no money, but we still got into festivals. We got taken seriously. We got mentioned in Variety a couple times because they were just starting to cover what's this crazy new media world, right?
Right.
So I said this at the first film festival we played. It was they were doing like a independent television section of their festival. Yep. And I freaked out because I was like, I shot this on camcorders from Best Buy. You have to show it to me. Can I please go in for 5 seconds and just see if it's going to overpixelate? You may not be able to use this. Like it's, right. I didn't shoot this. I shot this for at most a 13-inch screen. Like,
oh my gosh.
I shot this. This was on purpose shot to watch on a phone or an iPad. This was not meant to be blown up. And it did transfer fine, actually. And it played beautifully, but I was sweating bullets like ER. Like, I just was thinking about how similar those two moments were on the inside.
Yes.
But I said to somebody was like, well, you know, what do you, if you don't have the money, if you don't have this, and if, you know, if, but you want to do something, I was like, if you have a story to tell, you will find a way to tell it. Even if it's on a $350 camcorder, you will find a way to tell it. And that was when I started writing and directing, and I am doing some more stuff. Now I'm about to start pitching a pilot here in LA. I wrote a pilot for a production company here. Actually, I finished it right before I booked Preacher, and then they didn't want to move forward on it while I was under contract.
Gotcha.
I finished my pitch deck for it, and we're getting ready to try to push it out in the world. I'm really proud of it. I think it's the best thing I've ever written. But yeah, I've been writing, and I don't know if it'll see fruition or not, but I've been asked to direct a romantic comedy Christmas movie for a production company here. So we'll see if that comes to fruition or not. But it's I'm moving in several. I've got a lot of balls in the air. I'm moving in several different directions at once right now. Yeah,
that's so awesome. That is so great. Yeah. Well, since you brought up the whole Christmas holiday movie thing, yes, Christmas. It's that time of year again. It is the holidays.
Christmas on the Coast is coming to your TVs again.
It is. I actually did look up. It's going to be on Up TV, December 13th and 15th. A friend of mine just texted me Friday night that she was. It was a really sweet thing.
You're so good. It's so good. Yeah.
Thank you. But she was like, I've had a really crappy week. And she's like, and I just sat down with a glass of wine and I turned on the TV and there you were. And she's like, and now I am so happy. And she was watching us.
Yay.
Yeah. So I know that it's out there somewhere. It's surprisingly.
It's going to be on INSP again as well, okay. But I'm not sure of the dates, yeah. But Gary Wheeler has been posting about it coming back to INSP as well. And it's on Amazon.
You can get it through Amazon.
If you're interested in renting it,
yes,
or buying it.
It's $2.99. For $2.99, yes. You can rent it. Yeah, and then you big sci-fi nerd, Star Wars.
Yes.
Are you excited?
Dude, I went to Disney to Star Wars <you? laughs> Land for my
That's so awesome.
For my 20th wedding anniversary. That's what we chose to do. Okay, so
that's so great.
I married my college sweetheart. I married very, very young, and we this year had our 20th wedding anniversary, and we decided to take a group of friends and go to Disney for the day. We were like, oh, should we do a party? Should we do this? And I was in the middle of shooting Bosch, and Kevin was getting ready to leave to do his play, and everything seemed like a lot of work and more fun for everybody else. Like, mm-hmm. And I was like, I think we should go to Disneyland.
Yes.
We haven't seen Star Wars Land yet. It's so well done. It's
really
so beautifully done. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's better than Harry Potter World. I mean, it's so, okay. I flew the Millennium Falcon multiple times that day. It's the most amazing ride I've ever been on. It's like some mashup of it's like a cross between a theme park ride and a video game. You actually have mm-hmm. to participate.
Man.
Like you have to, and how long the ride lasts, the ride will be shorter the longer, the better you do, the longer the ride lasts.
That's cool.
It's so incredibly impressive. But yes, I'm a Star Wars girl for sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, how are you going to feel when it comes to an end?
It's not coming to an end. I mean,
that's what all the media says.
I mean, they're like spinning off of
right.
like zillion
right.
things, right? Like,
sure.
I mean, this
okay.
part of the saga is coming to an end.
Gotcha.
You know, here's how much of a Star Wars nerd I am.
Please tell me.
I think you know my husband and I take a lot of road trips. Like when we have time off, we like to go climb a mountain. We get in the car and we go. And we've driven cross country quite a lot. And when we drive cross country, we like to listen to Star Wars audiobooks.
Uh-huh. You are a nerd.
Oh, I'm a nerd. So they have the John Williams music, and awesome. They have the most amazing readers. Some of them have full casts, but most of them only don't, but they have amazing readers, and they have all of the sound effects. Like, even if you're just on a ship in the background, you hear, like, you hear, like, even just that amount, like, you hear, and you hear all the, you hear all of the, like, it's like listening to a movie. So fantastic. Wow. So the books, the new movies do not follow the storylines from the books. They went in a different direction. That doesn't bother me. Maybe because I'm a creative and I don't mind. Like, but there's a million audiobooks too that further that story in a different way than the new movies do. But if you're interested in Star Wars nerdery, you get on with the audiobooks. I like Legends of the Jedi, you know, but you can, or New Jedi Order, but they, if you go like on Wikipedia, which is Wikipedia.
Oh my God. Yes.
If you go on Wikipedia and put in audiobooks, then a whole list of them will come out and come up in chronological order for you. I like Mark Thomas as my favorite reader, but you know, that you can start at the beginning and go through them all. You can start partway through the story. You can start wherever you like. Yes.
Oh my God.
Nerd.
That is fantastic.
Big nerd. Yeah, but it. They're going to roll out Star Wars stuff forever. I mean, this part of it.
Sure.
I got to be honest with you. Like, when Carrie Fisher passed away, it kind of felt like it was done at that moment. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, that's, I know that sounds weird, but they'll roll out more story. But like, without, I was so happy that they included Harrison Ford and Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher in
that's what we grew up on.
Movies. And it was their story from the beginning. And I was so happy that they included them moving forward. And I feel like, I don't know, when she passed, I was like, wow, it really is sort of the end of an era. It's the end of what this is. Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, look, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to do the podcast with me, but at the same time, like, it's so great to just see you and catch up with you, because it's been since we finished Christmas on the Coast that we've talked, seen each other. I know we don't, you know, just
year
because of what we do, we don't get, oh no,
yeah,
closer.
2 years,
to,
2.5 years.
Yeah. If nothing else, I gave us an excuse to sit down face to face and catch up and say hi. It's so great to see you. Thanks for giving me, absolutely. And thanks for giving me part of your Sunday to do this.
Oh, thank you for having me. And I hope I didn't go off on too very many tangents.
It's fantastic. It's fantastic. This has been Julianne Emery on You May Have Seen. Thank you so much for listening.
Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if you'd like to leave a comment or review, that's always nice. You can also email us at youmayhaveseen@gmail.com if you have a comment or a question, and we'll give you a shout out in the next episode.